episode of Hashtag AmWriting is sponsored by Author Accelerator's Book Coach Training Program. If you've been hanging with us for a while, you've heard us talk about Author Accelerator's Book Coach Training and Book Coach Matching Services more than once. But here's a question we've never answered. Do you have to have written a book to become a book coach? Answer, nope. Book coaching, the art of guiding a writer into creating the best possible book at this moment in their career, is its very own thing, not unlike editing. How many novels did Maxwell Perkins write? Zero. And that was fine with F. Scott Fitzgerald, or at least I assume it was. I did not know either of them personally. Okay, apparently even that got complicated, but bear with me here. What I'm saying is that if becoming a book coach has been noodling around in your dreams, but you're afraid you don't have the experience, you need to put aside those fears and head over to Author Accelerator to learn more about how to take your passion for story and use it to help other writers get to where they want to be. Find out more at bookcoaches.com/amwriting.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. I don't remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause. I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now one, two, three.
Okay.
KJ Delantonia, and this is Hashtag AmWriting, the podcast about writing all the things, short things, long things, fictional, nonfiction, pitches, proposals, freelance work. This is the podcast about sitting down and getting your work done.
And I'm Serena Bowen. I'm the author of 35 romance novels, and my latest one is a really, really long thing. It came in at about 98,000 words. It's called Waylaid, and that was a little more than I planned to write.
No, your readers are going to love every single one of them. I guarantee it. I am KJ Delantonia. I am the author of the novel The Chicken Sisters, the nonfiction book How to Be a Happier Parent, and a former editor at the New York Times, where I ran the Motherlode blog. And we have a guest today that we are very, very excited to welcome, and I think y'all are really gonna, this is gonna be great. So welcome to Stacy Kim, who is a relatively new freelance writer who has recently had some really fantastic success and has agreed to come on and help walk us through what getting started in the world of writing is like right this very minute. So hi, welcome, Stacy.
Hi, I'm like so thrilled to be here. I've been a longtime listener of AmWriting. You got me through some really tough times, and so it's really thrilling to be here. So how did I get started? I was really trying to promote my coaching business. That's why I wanted to write, and I had been writing a email newsletter for a long time, and people would say, "Oh, you should write a book," and so I tried, but I just never could, I never really could get, you know, it off the ground. So a good friend of mine told me to take Sue Shapiro's class. I did that, thinking that I would write like a nonfiction service piece. I ended up writing a personal essay about coaching, and that was way back in like, I don't know, 2015, I think. And I don't know if I really want to do this personal essay thing. And then I was very lucky that a friend of mine pitched for me a piece to Real Simple. And she said, you know, you really need Real Simple to write about the Lighthouse Method that you talk about all the time. And so she wrote the pitch for me. I can't reveal who she is because I think, you know, but anyway,
did she actually pitch it to them, or did she write it and say, and now this is what you were going to say?
I found out later, but she actually said to them, you should have this person. And then I think she drafted a pitch that, you know, used my words, but she like, you know, adjusted it for me. And I was just floored. I couldn't believe that she was doing this for me. She's a very close friend now, but at the time, like, we were just beginning a friendship. And so we didn't hear back. And I just thought, okay, well, that's not going to happen. And then all of a sudden, they said, yes, we'd like for you to write it. And I had this wonderful editor who's no longer there, Elizabeth Sile, who just was so patient with me. She taught me the ropes. She really, you know, showed me so much. And the piece went gangbusters. But what really happened was we were so excited. My whole family was really excited that it was going to be coming out. And we were waiting every day for, because I was a Real Simple subscriber, and we were waiting every day for the issue to come in our in my mailbox. And I had like this marketing campaign I was going to launch around it, and I was really going to use it to promote my business. And on December 15th, 2017, my daughter was diagnosed with cancer. And it turned out to be one of the worst days of our lives. And I came home from a long day at the hospital with her. We've just learned the news. We found out that we were going to have to go through 9 months of chemotherapy. And so that day when I came home, I opened my mailbox and there was the Real Simple magazine. Oh. And at that moment, I just thought, I don't even want to look at it. I couldn't even open it. I just set it aside, and, you know, our life changed. And it was 9 months of hell. But during that time, you know, my friend who told me to take Sue Shapiro's class said, you got to write about this. You know, you have to keep writing. And I said, I can't. And I just couldn't, because every 20 minutes I would be interrupted with something. Like, you know, we would, our, you know, her pole would ring, or our neighbor's pole would ring, or somebody would be delivering food, or a volunteer would come in with her dog and say, hey, you know, do you want to pet a dog for a while? And, you know, there were all these things happening at the hospital. So I just started listening to Am Writing. And that was one of the things that I could do. I could like pause it. And, you know, it was perfect because it was released every Friday. Every Friday we had to go into the hospital. And that became part of my routine. And so you really became my writing community. And any moment I could, I would jot down notes about the experience. And then when it was all over, I tried writing. And I was so angry in my writing. I was so, I had so much pain in my writing that it didn't go anywhere. I would pitch or I would send it off, and it just wasn't accepted. And now when I look at it, I cringe.
Well, let's just back up and tell us, what kind of things were you sending personal essays, and what kind of places were you trying to send them to?
I tried the New York Times. I tried, I think there was a new column that doesn't exist in there anymore about like, I can't even remember what it was, but I was trying to write a personal essay, and I had so much pain. I was just talking about, you know, describing what it was like to be a mother of a cancer patient and what it was like at the hospital and this and that. And so I thought, you know what, I really need more critical feedback. You know, I can't just have my friends looking at this who were very gentle and felt sorry for me. And so I took Sue's class again. And, you know, she kind of, you know, helped me realize that there is a more universal story that I need to tell. And that actually there are so many people who pitch cancer stories that, you know, people are kind of tired of them. So I needed to come up with a different angle.
Well, so before we get to Sue's method, I want to back off and talk about that from an editorial perspective. I actually had this conversation with Daniel Jones at Modern Love as well, and I've had it with other editors too. It is true. Everyone wants to write their cancer story. Everyone wants to write the story of their parents' death. Everyone wants to write the story of their child's death, God forbid, if they experience it. And there are, first of all, there are only so many of those things that places can take. And they are universal experiences, but you got to find, like you were just saying, and like Sue is going to help you do, you have to find the universality of it. So I'm really, you know, it's really sort of just important to stop and go, when you were trying to just tell the story, you weren't getting anywhere. And that's not because editors don't care or you weren't writing it well or anything like that. It's more, it's just that to break through in those areas, really like anywhere else, it has to be really good. So I guess what I'm saying is the horrible thing that happens to us is rarely enough to to be a breakthrough thing on its own, you have to make something out of it. So it sounds like Sue helped you to learn to do that.
Yeah, I think it's that everybody suffers, right? It's like that Buddhist teaching that everybody suffers, but, and so that's what makes us connect, but there needs to be something a little bit different. And I think when I look back at that old writing, I was really complaining. I was, mm-hmm. you know, I was a victim, you know, my daughter was a victim and I was angry. And, you know, that was what I was really writing about. What Sue did was she's brilliant in that her first assignment is always to write a humiliation essay where you have to reveal your deepest, darkest, most embarrassing secret. And so that was how I think I looked at my daughter's cancer story and changed it so that I wasn't here the know-it-all, I wasn't here the victim, but I was here to learn something. And what I did in one essay was that the first one was Washington Post, and I talked, it was right around Thanksgiving, and I talked about how I could start to become more thankful again by being thankful for all those little things that I took for granted before cancer. And now we were really grateful for like little things like hair growth and, you know, things like that. And we were celebrating that. So that was that piece. The piece at the New York Times about the cancer story was really like, I couldn't handle all of those big emotions. And so I started hoarding, like I started, you know, bringing home the milk that they would throw away in the garbage, even though it was unopened, or the, you know, the thermometers, every time we went in there, we got a new stethoscope, you know, they would throw those away after we leave. And so I would start bringing them home and hoarding them, and I wouldn't throw away things. And it was kind of connected to my parents who had suffered through the Korean War. But also it was just my inability to kind of come to terms with the fact that I couldn't control what was happening to my daughter. And that was something that I couldn't control. And the other embarrassing thing there was that I, you know, my two daughters had this horrible screaming match. You know, it was just so embarrassing. And we live in New York City in an apartment, and I know my neighbors could hear it. It was just, they said the worst things to each other. And I was so embarrassed, but I realized that, you know, I saw my husband, he was so calm, and I realized, you know, he was giving them the opportunity to air out all of those negative feelings. And so I connected those two stories and said, okay, I needed to figure out how to let go of my negative feelings and kind of express that, or, you know, come to terms with those things. And that's why I think that story got sold. And then fast forward, you know, I again didn't write for a while. And
now I have another question.
Oh yeah, sure.
Initially got into this because you thought you would like to promote your coaching business.
Yeah.
These are not about promoting your coaching business. So let's talk about how your goal with the writing evolved.
You know, that's a really good question. I was very fortunate that that Real Simple article did help my business, even though mm-hmm. I couldn't promote around it. Like, it saved me. It saved my business because I was at the hospital all the time, but I was still getting client inquiries. So I worked it out so that I could, since we were always going in on Fridays, I, you know, coached on Thursdays. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I was able to squeeze it in. You know, I really tried to write service pieces, but I really struggle with writing. I find writing to be so difficult. I do continue to write the blog, and I've been trying to write more. I went from monthly to weekly, and that's, you know, a struggle, and it's hard. So what are my goals? I really don't know, and I think I've changed my approach about goals. COVID happened, and then the other bad thing that happened was my parents, and I realized I couldn't really set goals. And I think mm-hmm. that's kind of also what the Lighthouse Method is all about. And lately I've been more focused on, okay, I want to be a writer. And what does a writer do? A writer writes. So I am just going to write and learn how to do it as best as I can, which is what part of the reason why I upped the weekly blog post and things like that.
Can I ask, what does the lighthouse refer to?
Yeah, sure. It's so I, you know, coaching a lot of women, I noticed that, you know, these were really smart and talented women that were coming to me. And quite honestly, I didn't know how to help them figure out what they wanted to do with their lives. And that's why they were coming to me. And so, but they were so unhappy. And so I started saying, let's just try to, you know, let's not worry about the future. Let's just try to make now better. And so I would get them to do something fun and enjoyable. And at the same time, I would say, you know, you don't know what you want out there, but in order to go out there, so that you only can see the light of a lighthouse, like the glimmer of a light. You don't know what the lighthouse looks like. You don't know what, you know, where it is. But in order to get there, you need to get in your boat and start rowing. And, you know, it's night, so it's dark, so you don't know what that path is. And so the rowing was starting to do something more enjoyable. And as you did something more enjoyable, you realized, oh, I can get things done. I can do things. And then you start adding on, okay, well, what other things can I do to get myself to that general area? So someday, like if you use myself as an example, someday I'd like to write a book, but right now I don't know what that is. I don't know what I would be writing about. So instead, what I'm going to do is I'm going to get in my boat and start rowing every day. I'm going to write a weekly blog every week and just do my very best. And, you know, I just trust that eventually I'll get there, or I might end up at a lighthouse that's closer.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that instead of setting a long-term goal, you're just rowing your boat.
Yeah. Yeah.
you're taking steps towards something without forcing yourself to limit what that something is.
Right. I mean, I think actually, like, it's very similar to what KJ, you wrote in a freebie that you used to give out. I don't know if you still give it out on your website. It was about setting goals. And you also talk about it on your podcast. Mm-hmm. Like, every year you tell your listeners to set a goal that is achievable by you, not something that is done to you. Like,
right.
For example,
write a book is achievable, sell a book is not.
Right. And so it's similar to that. And I think this is the lighthouse method is for people who don't know where they're going. They mm-hmm. don't, you know, it's if you want to be a doctor, there is a very clear path that you need to take to become a doctor. If you want to be a lawyer, same thing. But if you don't know what it is that you want to do, then you can't draw a map. You can't, like, you know, set out a plan. And I think, you know, women who are perfectionistic, who are very smart, they believe that they need to have a plan before they make a move. And actually that keeps them more stuck. And so getting people to kind of go through the rhythm of doing something every day and doing something enjoyable and then adding on something a little bit more harder and, you know, just keep doing the very next step that will get you in that general direction. You know, I started doing that with my clients, and then they would, you know, all of a sudden they were there. They figured it out. They found out what they wanted. And so it was kind of like, you know, magic. But if you think about it, it isn't. You know, they were finding their path. They were finding the map as they rode. You know, the path became clearer. They saw what they needed to avoid and what they needed to go towards. Or they found, you know, by rowing out a little bit farther, they found the lighthouse that was closer. Sometimes, actually many of the times, the lighthouse was where they were, and so they go back to what they were doing.
It's a little bit like flipping a coin to figure out what it is you really want.
I don't know if it's flipping a coin, because
because when you flip the coin and get the answer, then you know if that was what you wanted or not. That's what I mean.
Oh, like, I see, yes.
It's not like flipping a coin at all, but sometimes you don't know what you want. And the only way to figure it out is to pick one and then go, right. Oh, well, wait, no, I was really
That's
hoping
right.
for the other one. And then you're
That's
like,
right.
oh, so this is, it's that. If I'm choosing to do these things, then I'm heading for that lighthouse.
Right. Like I often tell my clients, like, make a decision just for now. You can always change your mind, but just for now, let's decide. And sometimes we'll say, like, just for this week, try this, or that just for this month.
Right. I sometimes do that if I can't figure out what project I'm supposed to finish next. I'll tell myself, you know, just give it a week. You know, and of course you can't write an 80,000 word novel in a week, but if you give yourself to that project for 7 days, then you, at the end of that 7 days, will understand how invested you are or aren't without the noise of having to second guess yourself Wednesday.
Exactly. Yeah.
So when it came to shifting your focus around the writing and writing about these more personal things, was that, did you think at the time, oh, well, this isn't going to do me any professional good? Or were you just really focused on getting it? And I'm not saying it doesn't do you professional good. I guess I'm just interested in that. There's just a pretty big gap between I want to use this to promote my business and I can write about my family experiences. And when you say I want to be a writer, then it becomes more clear. But it doesn't feel like you started it, I want to be a writer. It feels like you started it, I want to promote my business. So right. How did you get from promotion to writer? Or were you hiding it all along?
I think that I always wished I could be a writer, but I never thought I could do it because it was so hard. My father's a writer. He's written many books. He was, you know, wrote a column in Korea for a long time. And I just didn't think I could do it. I wished I could. And I still find writing very difficult. But there are times when I just have something that I really, really want to say. And I think that's what drives me. And, it was having to go to Korea to help my parents during COVID. You know, it was just an all of a sudden awful thing that happened. And I went and I was so amazed with how the Korean government handled both COVID and, you know, elder care. Mm-hmm. And I was just so impressed. And I said, oh, people need to hear about this. And I thought, okay, I'm going to write an op-ed. But I thought, well, I'm not really the right person to. And so I took Sue's class again and I learned how to pitch. This time I took a pitching class. Mm-hmm. And I learned how to pitch. And I, you know, watched her very carefully. And she's super duper generous. You know, she brings in editors to her to the class. And then you can kind of ask them questions, not pitching them directly, but asking them general questions. And, you know, it was in a class where I kind of asked a question more generally, and then it got more specific. And during the class, Sue emailed me and she's like, she likes your piece. Go pitch her. You know, pitch her tonight. I'll look at it tonight. And, you know, she's just very generous that way. And
yeah, she is.
Yeah. And I just, I think that that's when I realized, okay, if I really want to make this sell, if I'm the person to write it, I also need to talk about, you know, how I was a self-loathing Korean American and how that's really why I was so impressed with Korea, was that that gap was so wide or so, you know, huge that, oh, sorry, that I didn't think that Korea could do something like that and be so kind and generous to my parents.
So it feels like this has really been a journey for you of finding your own permission to write. Or to say things, really, that maybe you didn't feel like were stuff that you wanted to say out loud in a public forum. So it's like you went from, okay, if I want to write, but I'm not sure I can do it, so I'll write about this thing I know, which is this lighthouse, you know, this thing that I coach, because this is a thing that I know. This is actually a really common, I think, journey for someone who's trying to find their way into writing, is to start with what I know that I can tell you, and then to sort of go on to maybe what I can learn, and then to go on to what I think. And it's just, it's sort of interesting to see it playing out for you, because it very clearly is.
I love that. I think that that's really true. I think, you know, it was about permission, because I had so much to say about Korean culture, and yet I couldn't figure out a way to say it. And so that's what over time, and I didn't feel like I had the authority to say it, or, you know, the permission from my parents, mm-hmm. or, you know, things like that too. So it was, I don't know if it's okay to mention this, but I pitched to you, I actually submitted an essay to you when you were at Motherload, and I wrote about my mother, and I didn't, you know, now when I look at it, I know exactly why you didn't accept it. And it was because there were things that I needed to say about my mother that I wasn't ready to say yet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now, you know, that she's going through what she's going through, I think it's a little easier to say, but I'm still processing that stuff too.
A lot of people try to write personal essays before they've processed the events, right. which they're, and most of right. us process by, or many of us process by writing. But then you think you're done and you're not, if that makes any sense. Like, I processed this, I wrote something, but I'm not no. actually done. So I don't want to steal Sue's class.
Yeah, you really should. You really yeah. should have her on the show
yeah.
or something.
We should. Like, I feel that's badly. Actually, yeah. Yeah, that's yeah. is not a bad idea. But so for you, what was the breakthrough that got you from, I guess the question is, how did you get past those superficial early drafts, which it sounds like is what you had? And I do not remember your submission, but I'm assuming that is probably what was wrong with it. So, how did you find that?
I think it really is about being willing to be more vulnerable, mm-hmm. and going deeper, and not trying to be the know-it-all. And I think that that's something that's really hard. Maybe it's because, like, of my academic training, or something. Like, it's very hard to be, to put yourself in that position, I think, where you are saying, like, okay, this is the bad thing I did, or this is the mistake mm-hmm. that I made. I think that's part of it.
Well, so let's talk about how you actually got the pieces out there once you were finished with them. How did you make contact? How did you present yourself? What was the pitching process like?
I think that I did my homework. I really kind of got to know what the editors were looking for. And I also tried really hard to think about, like, okay, what is it that I can say that's new and fresh? Mm-hmm. And what is it that I can talk about versus anyone else? Like, there's no one else who can write this piece. It's just me. And so finding that topic, and then, you know, making sure that, I guess what it is like just sending it out. Like, I think I was so afraid of, like, emailing editors. Mm-hmm. And so I just said, okay, I'm just going to email it out and see what happens. And so I think that was part of it.
So were you pitching fully realized pieces, or were you pitching ideas?
So for the last two pieces that I did, like for Wired magazine and for the most recent Washington Post article, those are pitches. And at the same time, the personal essay for the Washington Post, though, however, that was something that I had been kind of working on and trying to get sold for about a year. Mm-hmm. And it was something that I wanted to say, but either the timing wasn't right, or I wasn't, you know, who knows. And also, it started out as an op-ed, but I had no authority to write that piece, I realize now. And so when it turned into a personal essay, it made more sense. Then I was able to write that piece. That was my piece. And I was the only person who could write that piece. But for the Wired one, that one was actually more work-related. And that one, again,
Is that one about?
That one's about...
We'll put them in the show notes, everyone.
Okay, yeah, that was about the Got Done list. And the way I pitched that was that I said, you know, all of these productivity tools are lacking a feature that I find helps a lot mm-hmm. of smart and caring women. And it's essentially that, you know, rather than having a to-do list and having your, you know, when you're done with it, you know, it disappears often, like, you know, it'll disappear or it'll be archived, that task. I think it was very helpful to just keep a record of what you got done. And then there's also, you know, there are things that you never planned for that a lot of women, you know, accomplish in a day. For example, like if the car broke down, they take care of it, but that right. was never on your to-do list. The dishwasher broke, you know, I fixed it or I got it fixed. That was never on your to-do list. And so
this was more back in your service wheelhouse.
This was in the service wheelhouse. And so mm-hmm. that I pitched and it worked out. And I actually knew Alan Henry's work from Life Hacker. I was a big fan of his when he was back at that publication. So, you know, I could say, hey, I really miss your pieces on this and mm-hmm. and introduce it and then say, here's my idea. And he
liked
it. So
you're not pitching something generic that you're pitching to a bunch of editors. You're
right.
This was at least every pitch is specific, which is great.
Yes. So it was just, I learned that I needed to not only be the right authority for that piece, but I also needed to find a place that wanted that piece and mm-hmm. or needed that piece so that it was an easier sell.
I feel like editors can always hear that kind of engagement as well. When you're writing to an editor whose pieces you've read before, it's just different than hearing from somebody who woke up that morning and decided to be a writer. Like, you know, that that intro line shows your commitment and your, you know, interest in the job as well as just the piece you're pitching. And that's just going to wake somebody up in a way that, you know, nothing else can.
What does it look like, a pitch from you?
So an email, mm-hmm. You start out, actually it starts with a good subject line, I think, you know, just really making sure that it captures, I think I spend more time on the subject line than anything.
Do you put the word pitch or something like that in your
I do put pitch. And then, you know, if it's a timely pitch, I'll say timely pitch.
And then are you trying to get a headline or are you just trying to give a topic or does it vary?
I think it's never a topic. It's definitely a headline. It could mm-hmm. possibly be the headline that would work in a headline for the story. But also if it's, you know, if the hook is really about like, you know, I'm a self-loathing Korean American, you know, they think that if that's a part of the piece or if it's, you know.
Okay. So, yeah.
It's either, so it's so whatever.
Possible headline or the hook.
The hook. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Got
and
it.
Then, and then I start out with a compliment to show that I read the person's work and say, and then just get right into it. Like, I'd like for you to consider this piece. And I describe it as best as I can. It's never a topic. I try to kind of summarize very quickly what it is, what the story is going to be about, and at the same time say why I should be the one to write it,
mm-hmm.
why I'm the only person who can write it, if possible. And then I say thank you for considering. And, you know, if it's not timely, I won't say it's timely. But if it is timely, I said, oh, this could be blah, blah, blah.
Right.
This could work for whatever. And then I send it off and...
What are your rules for following up?
I, you know, sometimes like I'll hear from other writers like, oh, you know, you should wait for this amount of time. I think I'll wait like 2 weeks and then mm-hmm. I'll send again. They're excruciating weeks, but, I found that for me at least, like if they like it, they get back to me pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And so... So then I know that I've done my job.
Right. Well, I have one last question for you. In your email to us, so long time ago, when Jess and I interviewed David Sedaris, he gave some advice on the podcast, which we've commonly referred to since as the worst advice ever given on the hashtag and writing podcast. And it was basically, could be summed up as just wait until they call you. Wait until the New Yorker reaches out. And we were like, no, that does not work for anyone. But you said that you didn't think it was at least the worst advice ever. And I would love to hear why not.
Okay. I heard it very differently. I totally get why you think it's worth some advice. And I think that if you interpret it that way, it would be. I think that famous people, and just having coached a lot, I think that people don't give very good advice. They are not able to see what it is that they do so well that they take it for granted. And so I don't think he was giving advice when he said that. I actually think he was complaining. I think he was saying, like, you know what? I can't stand the people who come up to me and say, hey, read my work. You know, I really didn't think that he was giving advice. Because if you, rather than hear, you know, take the advice of what he said, I would actually take the advice of what he did. And what he did was he said that he went to every reading he possibly could. And he read and read. And then somebody noticed him and said, hey, come to my reading. And he would say yes to that. And he would go. And so he kept doing that. But then what I also think I heard him say was that he wrote in his journal all the time. He was really honing his craft. He was really trying to be funny and really working at it. And I'm also a big fan of Cal Newport. And he wrote a whole book on a quote that Steve Martin said, which is, be so good they can't ignore you. And I think that is, he is a great example for that book. And so he couldn't be ignored. I also think, on another note, I think really people do really want to help other people and they want to discover the new thing. Like, if I find a foot cream that is awesome, I'm sending it out to all of my girlfriends, right? I'm buying it myself and sending it out to all of them. I think that, you know, feeling is very common. And so he was saying, well, why not give the gift of somebody to somebody of being found? And he clearly likes doing that. He likes to bring people up and say, oh yeah, I found this wonderful writer and I'm gonna have her open for me. He talked about that. And when he was talking about it, his voice got happier and lighter. And so he's just that type. I think he's just that type of person who doesn't want to be told what to do. You know, he'd rather do it himself. And that's why I think.
Yeah. We could kind of sum it up as do hone your craft. Do your best to get everything out there. Do pitch editors. Don't pitch David Sedaris.
That's right. So, yeah. So that's my take on it. And my takeaway is my personal takeaway is, okay, I'm going to try and do my best to be as great a writer as I can. So I'm going to spend more time on that and less time on social media. That was kind of my way of saying, okay, I'm not going to just thrust it. Yeah, I'm not going to thrust my work on people. I'm just really going to target it to people who really would like to read it.
Well, it's a fun episode, and I will put it in the show notes for everyone.
Yeah, I re-listened to it.
We don't mean to be down on David Sedaris. We adore him. It was just a funny moment when it felt like he was saying, don't pitch. It's like, wait, no, that's a really bad plan. But yeah, I think that you are probably right. He was saying a couple of things there, but he was not saying sit around in your apartment and wait to be discovered.
He actually, I re-listened to it, and he actually kind of, I mean,
he
that's
did
why
say did, that, he but did I don't think it. He yeah. really meant it.
No, I don't think so. Yeah. I don't think so, yeah.
But it's fun to pretend he did.
Yeah, that's right.
So let's take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and talk about what we have been reading lately. Hey, listeners. Would you like to know when a fresh episode of Hashtag AmWriting is ready? Hear all the details when we accidentally don't drop an episode on time, or get KJ's random top thoughts while recording an episode as memorialized in the show notes? Subscribe to our weekly podcast email at amwritingpodcast.com, and all of that can be yours. Plus, if you decide to support the pod, you'll get writer top fives and bonus episodes, as well as access to all the earlier bonuses on things like recording audiobooks, finding an agent, starting a revision, and book launches. Find out more at amwritingpodcast.com. Great, Stacy. So, have you read anything good lately?
I have. Thanks to your podcast, read Ethan Cross and Jeff Salingo. However, I do want to put in a plug for something that I read a while back, since it is, I don't know if this is going to be airing in AAPI month, but I really, really enjoyed If I Had Your Face by Frances Cha. It's, you know, by a Korean-American author who goes back to Korea and really kind of reveals the underbelly of some of the sex industry. And I also really enjoyed Miracle Creek by Angie Kim.
Oh, I know her. That's great.
Yeah, it was a fun thriller. And there are moments in that book where she reveals some dark, deep secrets about parenting and, you know, what maybe every parent thinks but would never dare say. And I just love that she said them. So those are two books that I really enjoyed.
Well, I just finished something super fun, which is coming out right about the same time that this podcast will come out, which will be in May. And we're pretty much recording contemporaneously. We're basically talking directly to y'all because it's just going to be a couple days. I just finished Lauren Weisberger's Where the Grass is Green and the Girls are Pretty, which is kind of a funny title, although it totally makes sense. It is about a family caught up in the college admissions scandal. It is as scandalous and delicious and delightful as you would expect Lauren Weisberger to be. I really enjoyed it. It has some character who thinks they're a white savior issues, kind of maybe a little bit around that. Sort of buried in there, so I will throw that out as kind of a warning flag. But by and large, it's everything that you would expect if the author of The Devil Wears Prada took on the college admission scandal.
Cool. And I'm reading a book called Reality is Broken by Jane McGonigal, which is a narrative nonfiction about gamification and what gamers know about self-motivation that the rest of the world should know.
I love her. I had interviewed her for other pieces. She is great. So that sounds really fun.
Those sound amazing.
Well, this was really fun, Stacey. We're so glad that you reached out to us because this has been exciting and I think really useful for people. It does get hard. Frankly, I haven't pitched an editor in a while. I would be super anxious and will be super anxious when it comes time to doing it. I am resisting doing it because it is still painful and awful, but it is also harder for me to say, and this is how you do it for the first time, because it's even if it's the first time for the editor, you know, I get to come into it a little bit as a known quantity, which may or may not help. Who knows? So it was great to talk to someone who's a little fresher to the whole thing. We really appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you so much for everything that the three of you do for the writing community. It's just such a wonderful thing for you to tell us how it is and like talk numbers and you know, let us know about books and gifts to give. And it's just been, and for me personally, again, it was really a lifesaver and when I needed it. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. Where can people find you online?
Just lifejunctions.com is probably the best place. I'm on some social media, but I really try not to be.
So, good for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're always working around that. Until next week, everyone, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
The Hashtag Am Writing podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Pause. Stop.
Stop.
Thank you.